Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I want to welcome you all to our Independent Policy Forum program this evening. As some of you know, we conduct Independent Policy Forums about monthly. The forum is a series of lectures and debates and panel discussions on important public policy issues, and they're held here in our conference center in Oakland. This evening, the title of our program is Smarter Urban Growth, Markets, or Bureaucracy. And we're very privileged to have two urban economists joining with us as our speakers. Again, those of you who have not seen them yet, this is one of the two books we're featuring by Randall O'Toole. It's called The Vanishing Automobile and Other Urban Myths, which I highly recommend. And the second one is called Curb Rights, by Daniel Klein, our other speaker. And if you can, I would highly recommend that you try and get both books because they're very unique and very germane to our topic. For those of you who are new to the Institute, hopefully you received a packet when you registered. You'll find information about our publications and our other events. You're also welcome to give us your email address because we have a weekly email newsletter that we send out, which you might find of particular interest. It also alerts people to upcoming events and many studies we do, and so on and so forth. The Institute also publishes a journal called The Independent Review. Both of our speakers have been authors in The Independent Review. And the policy is that the doors will be locked until everyone here subscribes. So that's that's just a fair warning. Our program this evening, in the aftermath of what is, as we all know, a horrific calamity, especially in New York, a horrific urban calamity, also relates in some ways to the topic of tonight as far as how we deal with urban problems. During the last decade, there are a lot of things you can say about these topics, and I'll leave that to our speakers, but a couple of things I just wanted to point out was here in the Bay Area during the last decade, new housing construction barely kept up with demand created by the population growth of the area. With the number of new jobs created, about 70,000 new international residents entered the Bay Area, not including residents who are already citizens. In the East Bay, there are more than five times the number of jobs created as there were homes built in 1999. The number of new housing units built in the East Bay actually declined 21% between 1997 and 1999. The reason for this lag is a proliferation of housing and land use controls that prevent new construction, adjustment of existing units, and so on and so forth. And these include growth controls and density restrictions and many other policies. The consequence, of course, has been to bid up the existing stock of homes and rental units at an incredible rate. Even with the economic downturn, it's amazing at how resilient the prices have been. For example, apartment rents rose 44% in Alameda County and 36% in Contra Costa County. From 1993 to 1999, just 6 years. And other Bay Area counties have been far worse. So with astounding housing costs and escalation of costs, as well as what has become suffocating traffic congestion, some of you have traveled from across the Bay and you're well aware of this, pollution and a wide range of other issues, there have been various proposals that have been made to deal with this. One series of proposals is called Smart Growth, which will be addressed in part tonight, which is essentially a proposal for government-mandated high-density urban living and public transit, of course subsidized by taxpayers. The question, though, is how exactly can we deal with problems in a way that is actually going to be productive? Do we just mandate government policy and have people adhere to that, or would that cause even worse problems? Our first speaker is Daniel Klein. Dan is Associate Professor of Economics and general director of the Civil Society Institute at Santa Clara University. He's also been a research fellow at the Independent Institute. He's a contributor to a book we have coming out from the University of Michigan Press this winter called The Voluntary City. And in your packet, there's an insert about that book. I also want to point out that the center that Dan is general director of has just published this monograph called Why is Housing So Expensive in Silicon Valley? And I highly recommend this. I believe it's also on your website, too. Is that right? So anyone interested in that can get more information from Dan about that. Dan received his PhD in economics from New York University. He's been a visiting fellow at the Social Philosophy and Policy Center at Bowling Green State University. He's been a visiting scholar at the City University in Stockholm, Sweden. He's been an assistant professor of economics at UC Irvine. He's also been a visiting scholar in the Department of Economics at Stanford. In addition to Curb Rights, his other books and monographs include What Do Economists Contribute?, Reputation, A Plea to Economists Who Favor Liberty, Assurance and Trust in a Great Society, and Three Libertarian Essays. His articles have appeared in many journals, and I'm very pleased to introduce Dan Klein.
Thank you. I need to speak into this mainly for recording purposes. Good evening. Nice to be here. Nice to see you. I wrote that book with two graduate students. And what we say in this book, I'm going to say a minute about what we say in this book and then not say much about this book. We sort of seized on the insight that a real important resource in urban transit markets, especially route-based vehicle markets, buses, jitneys, is bus stops, congregation areas for passengers, curb zones for the vehicles. We realize that that's a real important piece of the puzzle. And what we essentially do here is propose the privatization of bus stops and of curb zones and bus stations, and have leaseholders of the curb zones contract with carriers to provide transit services. Now, this is a somewhat novel idea, and if I may say so, and I think it actually makes a lot of sense. It's sort of way outside the 40-yard lines of the discussion, right? I mean, they can't even privatize the buses for the most part. They're about to privatize the bus stops and the sidewalks. And I encourage, I invite you to look at this, but what I thought I would do tonight is actually give a more general sort of the wisdom of transportation economists on urban transit issues, not so specific to this proposal. And I made up that lengthy handout to give just sort of the ground zero, what I would consider a ground zero understanding of this. I'm going to try to keep this brief and roll through this handout that I gave you. Maybe it's best to focus our attention up here. You can look at the handout later when you want to refresh yourself afterward. So ideas for improving mobility in public policy. I'm taking a lot of my material from Wendell Cox's site. He uses all the standard data sources. Very good site here listed on my first page, publicpurpose.com. Friends of Wendell's include Tom Rubin here and Randall O'Toole. These guys both do urban transit as much as I do, so these guys are probably actually more on top of a lot of this than I am. All of these slides make one simple point, so we're going to just roll through them. This is millions of vehicle kilometers per square mile of public transport. There is a U.S. Thing over there. It's just so small. The situation in the U.S. is profoundly different from much of the world. People ask, why is America so rich? Oh, thanks. And there's a few reasons why you might explain why America's so rich. And people say, well, it's the biggest country. It's one of the freest countries. One of the important reasons America's so rich is because it was developed in the age of the automobile. And the automobile is an incredibly powerful form of communication and transportation, unbelievably powerful. And we, our urban form was developed in that age to a great extent, our suburbs even back east. And that's one reason we are so rich. Trying to make us like Europe, like so many of the urban planners and transit planners want, is actually sort of retrogressive. More just about America and how it's different. Let's see if I can get this. This is public transport passenger kilometers over motorized, you know, automobile passenger kilometers. U.S. is tiny compared to the rest of the world. We have a completely different situation here. Thank goodness. Public transport use and population by U.S. metropolitan sectors. We've got fairly high numbers of public transport boardings only in the cores, okay, not in the suburbs, which increasingly our urban areas are, okay? There's no longer the urban structure of the dense downtown and sort of spreading from there. Everything is very dispersed, and increasingly so. This one's blank. This is Atlanta. Employment location of Greater Atlanta, the central business district is only that much. This is five edge cities that are noteworthy, and then everywhere else. Okay, there is no urban form, increasingly. U.S. core population density, in that center column, New York 10,000, Chicago 4,700. Those are exceptional in the U.S. They have rail systems that cover their operating costs or nearly cover their operating costs. Building rail in these other places is really a remarkable thing. If you compare it to these other cities in the world like Tokyo and Paris, the conditions are extremely, extremely different. Why is the automobile so wonderful? Here are some points. It's remarkably flexible in just so many ways. It travels to all points known to man and pavement. It goes when you want to drive it, and it's there for you, waiting for you, until you're ready to drive it. It goes door to door. You can go with or without your pals in the car. You don't have to make transfer stops, waiting, or anything of that sort. It's much faster than other modes of urban transit. Its costs and affordability in America are very good, and automobile access by driver-licensed-aged people is approaching saturation. 90% of driver-licensed-aged people have a license, and 90% of those people have access to an automobile. So it's actually bumping up to the ceiling. That's one reason why traffic congestion won't keep continually getting worse, because all potential drivers practically now have come up to have a car, and so you can only go so high. Energy use, it's very good relative to rail and the other forms. Seat availability compared to a bus, sometimes you have to stand on the bus. Comfort, reliability, security, very important. Freight and storage, you know, you can go shopping at the supermarket with your car a lot easier than you can if you take the bus. Privacy, and cars are also forms of shelter, places where you might sleep in a pinch, or make love in, or do all sorts of other things that cars are famous and appreciated for. And that's why the U.S. urban public transit market has been shrinking. Okay, from 1945 down to 1995, it's down to like 2% of travel. Okay, the automobile has triumphed. A lot of blank slides in here. Light rail and rail systems are a bane. They're lousy forms of mobility. This is passenger miles per route mile, 1996. Compared to freeway lanes, they don't move people nearly as well, nearly as much. San Jose does a particularly awful job. Here's compared to freeway lanes, the darkened areas, I think something like 9% of what the freeway lane would achieve. And anytime you put down a rail line, you could have put down pavement and given people a highway lane or two, or an arterial street, you know, with lights and 7-Elevens and stuff. And those are better for mobility too. Wendell Cox did this wonderful study of new rail projects. This is kind of complicated, but I just want to bring your attention here. This is annualized cost per new public transport passenger. Okay? And as he says, you know, why don't we just rent people BMWs? Why don't we just lease all these potential new public transport riders BMWs? It would be cheaper. This is a figure from my book, earnings, that is to say revenues of all modes of public transport, we had it up to 1992, is only 31 cents on the dollar. So it's a huge loss-making thing, of course, being paid by taxpayers of all sorts. A desire named streetcar. Why the continual push, especially for rail transit? Despite the fact that it's a lousy form of mobility, it hurts the poor, it hurts the poor's mobility for a whole bunch of reasons, partly because rail projects tend to cannibalize bus systems, the public bus system, which is actually a better and cheaper and more powerful form of transportation. Why does this happen? First of all, there's major pork involved from the feds and from the other levels of government. That's a huge part of it. Also, city planners, city officials, and so on consider rail transit as a monument, essentially, a symbol of a world-class status city. Like, we're a real city, we have rail. This has been called infrastructure envy. I think the people's romance, as I call it, is a real important concept here. It's like a public monument, and it's something which people who sort of like the collectivist idea sort of yearn for, okay, and consume in a sense. They like the idea that we, the people, have built this rail project, which we can all kind of see nicely going along the landscape. When we go on it, we're all having this shared, you know, experience in motion through space. We all built this through our agents, the government, and using tax dollars. And it's all part of a collectivist experience. And the people who especially yearn for that are very prepared to, you know, put other people's money towards satisfying that craving, okay? Which is very, very unfortunate. We have all sorts of, I think the people's romance is actually, you know, the force behind a lot of what is done in public policy. The rest is really window dressing. And the cost falls on people who are not so interested in the people's romance, and very often the poor who are hurt by a lot of these bad policies, like housing markets, when they can't afford housing. And then there's just layered on top of that the normal public ignorance of how lousy rail is. People just don't know. The journalists don't really tell them. It's hard for people to find out, and they don't have much incentive to find out. You know, what good is it to find out another way that the government's kind of making things crummy when you can't do anything about it? It's not really, you know, ignorance is bliss. Okay, so let me just give you some sort of standard transportation economist answers about how policy should be reformed. It's really not tricky. First, under the heading of improved automobility, and then decontrolling transit, allowing transit to become more like the automobile, in fact. Improving automobility, well, on highways, it's real simple. Charge users. We now have electronic toll collection. We're all familiar with it. Toll collection's not a problem. It's as easy as paying your phone bill now. Paying a highway bill would be as easy as paying a monthly phone bill. Using electronic toll collection. Electronic toll collection would eliminate congestion. It would increase throughput, at least when you have congestion that slows things down below, say, 45 miles an hour, because you actually have higher throughput. It's a little bit paradoxical because you see all those cars on the road, but there's actually fewer going through per hour when speeds are below 45 miles an hour. It would actually reduce pollution from cars, which is minimized at around 90 kilometers an hour. Okay. So it would reduce pollution. It would reduce congestion. It would give a revenue source for supply to come forward, okay, to provide new capacity, new highway capacity. And having that revenue source come directly from actually supplying it means that you get a mechanism that would match supply to demand, which is the whole magic, in a sense, of markets, that opportunities for profits arise where there's actually demands. People are actually willing to pay, voluntarily pay their dollars for your provisions. You don't have to rely so much on central planning, because decentralized action creates these profit opportunities where they are socially needed. It makes possible, because of the revenue stream, privatization, which brings, you know, improved innovation and entrepreneurship to the whole job of highway provision. The other big thing to do to improve basically highway usage and service is to ease the entitlement process to building new roads and highway facilities. It's extremely hard now to clear a highway, to get all the environmental clearance and all the other kinds of clearance. That whole entitlement process has become so expensive, so prolonged, and so uncertain that it's now a major obstacle to improvements in the highway system and the road system. On transit, I would say get the feds out. It's a local issue. Let local people deal with it, even if it's going to be local government. Get the feds out. Convert many rail lines to roads or dedicated busways. You could have all sorts of express buses going point to point over dedicated busways that would get people to their destinations at least as well and a lot cheaper. Privatize and contract out bus services. Economists have studied, you know, the experience of this. It's lower cost, it's generally better service, like privatization and contracting out usually is. Taxi markets are highly monopolized by local governments. Set numbers of cabs or licenses are given out. This could be opened up to entry. There could be more competition, lower taxi rates. You could let people share their taxi ride, okay, where you know, several people can go if they're going to similar destinations. There's laws against that now in most local taxi markets. Let them set their own prices. For our dispersed urban structure or urban form, van services of different kinds would be a huge profit opportunity, but for the fact that the state governments don't allow it. They just don't allow it. Why don't we have the private sector solution? They're not allowed to do it. The government has made exceptions in the case of services originating at or terminating at airports. And that's why we are all familiar with Super Shuttle and the like. But they don't allow this, generally speaking, for kids going to football or soccer or music lessons or school or whatever, okay? Or just commuters subscribing to a regular van service that picks up a, you know, pattern of usage and all that. On-the-spot carpooling is an interesting phenomenon that I think could be done a lot more. Maybe you've heard stories about where they have HUV 3, high occupancy vehicle 3, you need three people in the car, and spontaneous collection points for people to sit down in your car developed. This was in Washington especially. I think it's happened here at the bridge, right? And this is something which probably could be done a lot more if it were permitted and encouraged and so on. But it's generally not. Now, for route-based transit, our idea of curb rights could be entertained, where you actually have entrepreneurs taking over bus stations, curb zones, bus stops, and then they being the ones who contract with carriers and decide when you can bring your vehicle up there, you know, when what passengers you sort of have the right to invite into your vehicle, and so on. And there's a lot of interesting virtues actually to that, which I'll just refer you to the book on. So that's a sort of a standard economist's take on the whole transit issue. I'm really not saying anything radical at all from the point of view of a transportation economist. I've worked with a bunch of these people. I was at University of California, which has very good transportation economists for many years. And as I say here, I can't speak for anyone but myself, but I submit that most leading transportation economists would agree that policy should be moved significantly in the direction of tolling, deregulation, and privatization. Economists do reach a conclusion, okay? It's kind of a well-kept secret in many respects. But when you look at the economists who would do applied work, who actually get their hands dirty in an applied policy issue, especially of a sort of what we call microeconomic, like these, microeconomic topic, most of them actually do come to the conclusion that policy ought to be reformed in the direction of these things. We're all going to disagree about how far it should go, whether highways should be entirely privately owned. I might be more radical than a lot of these people, but that's not what I'm saying. Everyone who actually does the math, as it were, on this comes to the conclusion that policy ought to be reformed in this direction. And so that's all I really want to bring to you tonight, is just sort of Adam Smith's representative, just the yeoman economist telling you, yeah, water does run downhill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.